Minnesota. Dr. Hill has worked with Dr. David Tillman over there, and I know that some of you are acquainted with that name from Senator Vickerman's committee. But, you know, we're looking, we had asked Dr. Hill to come specifically to look at some carbon-negative biofuels and look at some of the comparisons that we have between what we're currently doing and what might be done in the future. Dr. Hill, if you don't mind introducing yourself for the tape, and then, you know, I think your information is on the slide there, but if you want to say a little bit about your title and what the research that you're involved in before you go ahead, that'd be fine.
Thank you. Jason Hill. I'm in the Department of Applied Economics and the Department of Ecology, Evolution, Behavior. I have a unique joint appointment between the two with David Tillman in ecology and Stephen Pulaski, my other advisor in applied economics. I have been working on this project for a couple years now, and this last summer we put out some work on corn ethanol, soy biodiesel comparisons to help us better understand the current state of biofuel production. And then this last December, we had published in Science, which is in your packets, a paper on prairie biofuels, using prairie biomass for biofuels. And I'm going to speak about both of those today, as well as some integration between the two papers that we're working on currently. Also want to note here that in the title of my talk, what I'm going to be doing is looking at many different aspects of biofuel production, the energetics, how much energy we get back from the energy we invest, the expectations, what we can expect them to do for us as a society, the environmental concerns and the economic concerns. And your subdivision here is wonderfully nested among many of these terms, and you see the benefit of looking at all of these different aspects, and you really need to consider them all in order to understand the true benefit of these. So there's no doubt that we are searching quite intently for renewable transportation fuels. We're overwhelmingly dependent on fossil fuels, 90% of our total energy use, high energy prices, increasing energy imports, concerns about our petroleum supplies, both domestically and across seas, and, of course, the environmental consequences of burning fossil fuels. Are biofuels the answer? If you look at the advertisements, you might get the impression that they most certainly are. GM has its large Live Green, Go Yellow campaign. Willie Nelson is promoting biodiesel. And then other groups are suggesting things such as 85% less foreign oil with E85 and biodiesel being 100% renewable fuel, 100% made in America with zero dependence on foreign oil. And what I'm going to talk about in future slides is why that might not necessarily be the case when we look at many of the aspects of these biofuels. So as I said before, I'm going to talk about these four E's of renewable energy, energetics, expectations, environment, and economics. And I'm part of a larger team that's supported by IRE, the Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment, that the state has so kindly sponsored. And we bring together researchers from the Applied Economics Department, Ecology, Engineering, Agriculture, many different areas. And so we're looking at a single problem from a number of different disciplines, and we think that in considering biofuels, you really need to look at all these aspects. You can't ignore any one of them. So I'm going to tell you a tale of two biofuels here. Our first paper looked at a comparison between the life cycles of corn grain ethanol and soybean biodiesel. Here, of course, is corn converted to ethanol. DDGS, the distiller's dry grain with solubles, a co-product that comes from that, a high-quality animal feed. And I see that QuickTime is giving me a little trouble here. Soybean biodiesel, of course, we crush the soybeans to produce soy meal, which is the main product of importance from soybeans. But we also get the soy oil, which can be converted to biodiesel, which is becoming increasingly a valuable product for transportation needs. And I should also point out that these two biofuels, especially ethanol, have been used and considered primarily as additives to fuel to displace either MTBE for ethanol or high sulfur levels for biodiesel. And what we're talking about here in this transportation fuel presentation I'm giving is using them as energy sources, using them as actual fuels, not fuel additives. So let's start with the energetics. What can we expect? What sort of expectations do we have for these biofuels to offset our fossil fuel use? In 2006, 17% of our national corn harvest was converted to ethanol, and that offset on a gross basis 2.1% of our gasoline use. So we can see the disproportionate effect of utilizing corn on our food markets relative to our energy markets. Soy biodiesel, 5.3% of the soybean harvest, and really the oil from that harvest, was used to produce biodiesel, which offset 0.3% of our diesel use gross. And so the question mark here is for us to look at next the energy components so that we can understand what the net energy return is from these biofuels. Also, what energy sources are used in producing them. We want to know want to be able to trace the fossil fuels used in their production. So let's consider the life cycle of biofuels. We need to look at all the energy inputs from farming through conversion and transportation, as well as the outputs. What biofuels do we get out, as well as the co-products, which can be assigned some energy equivalents. And to do so, we need to look beginning at the farm. Corn farming uses fossil fuels, primarily diesel, to produce both the corn and soybeans. Fertilizer production requires fossil fuels, natural gas primarily. We need to transport our crops to the production facility. We need to actually produce the ethanol or biodiesel itself and then transport that to the point of end use. We also want to produce the co-products and sell those and use those for various reasons. So this slide, there's a lot going on here, but this summarizes our findings from the paper of the net energy balance of these biofuels. What energy return do you get in producing them? Is there something I can point with or for this? Do we have? Thank you, Doug. What we have here on the left of each pair of bars here are the energy outputs from the biofuel production. Here we're looking at corn ethanol production. On the right, we're looking at soybean biodiesel production. On the right, we have the energy used to produce the biofuels, used both in the farm and in processing. So everything below this line is farm energy use. Everything above this line is processing energy use. So for corn ethanol, we've defined the energy output as 1. That's the amount, total amount of energy output. And then up here we have the co-product energy equivalent that's given. So a total output of about 1.2 here. And total inputs on the farm include the production of the seed that's planted to produce the biofuel, the fossil fuel used on the farm itself, the energy input required to produce fertilizers and pesticides, the energy used in machinery production, producing the tractors and combines and so forth that are used on the farm, household energy use on the farm, and then in processing we have transportation, the energy required to produce the ethanol or biodiesel facilities, and then the energy used within the facility itself. So we see here for the corn ethanol net energy balance that we have a difference of this amount right here, which is the net energy balance of about 0.24, The net energy balance ratio here tells us we get out 25% more energy in producing ethanol than we put in. For soy biodiesel, similar here, we have the energy in the biodiesel itself as an output. We have the output of the soybean meal and then the output of the glycerol, which is a co-product from production of the biodiesel itself. Energy inputs, we have the fossil fuel use on the farm, fertilizer, pesticide, again, household energy use. This is large relative to corn because we get out so much more corn ethanol on a per acre basis than we do soy biodiesel. And then we have processing energy here. And notice here the processing energy for soy biodiesel is very small relative to that in corn ethanol production because of all the energy required to distill the beer, as it's called, the low alcohol content product of fermentation into the final product. Soy biodiesel gives us back about 93% more energy than corn ethanol does. So armed with those 25% and 93% numbers on the net energy return, we can go back and fill in what the net energy gain in terms of the fossil fuels that are displaced in the market from corn ethanol production and soy biodiesel production. That 17% of the corn harvest had a net effect in terms of the energy that we were returned back as a society of 0.4% of our gasoline use. Okay. The difference between the gross and the net here is all the diesel, natural gas, and coal to produce electricity used in ethanol and corn production. Soy biodiesel use here, a net return of about 0.2% of our diesel use. So we always need to consider the net energy return and not the gross energy return when looking at these different fuels. For the environmental concerns, we again need to look at the full life cycle. We need to look at what the effects are.
Excuse me, Dr. Hill, we have a question. Senator Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it's all right to interrupt.
I think that's fine. Okay. Would you prefer it another way, Dr. Hill?
No, this is fine.
All right.
Yes.
Okay.
Let me just ask, if I may, what you were looking at when you counted all the energy going into the making of the ethanol, the corn ethanol, was that kind of an average? I mean, I know there are one or two plants that are trying to use renewable energy to produce their ethanol.
Yes.
You know, and use the byproducts for their electricity, et cetera.
Yes.
Obviously, that would change the net.
Exactly.
So do you have any information about that?
I do. I will speak later on here on the use of prairie biomass. That's the culmination of this. Douglas Tiffany here is an expert and has published extensively in using these co-products for powering the plant. So he will give us some information on that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess
Dr.
Hill, that's helpful. But one thing I want to get at also is what the impact is of at least producing corn ethanol in a more sustainable way rather than using a fossil fuel to
yes.
produce it.
Yes. So the impact, Senator Anderson, the impact would be to reduce this bar here,
okay.
the facility energy use. So any amount that we reduce this would add to our net energy gain and would also increase our net energy return as a percentage. That is correct. But again, the we have to look at the limits here. This is the maximum, if we will have it this way. And then our net energy return here is affected by that,
sure.
which you mentioned.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Hill, you want to continue?
Thank you. So we need to look at environmental effects here, both in corn farming and transportation of the crop to the facility and so forth, all the way. And this time we need to consider even combustion of these biofuels as well. So environmental effects of corn ethanol relative to soy biodiesel. What we have here is the amount of different fertilizers applied per net energy gain in producing the biofuel. And we see that for nitrogen, only 1% of the nitrogen is used in soy biodiesel production relative to corn ethanol production. This is because soy beans are able to fix their own nitrogen with the help of microbial symbiotes, and the tremendous nitrogen requirements needed for corn. On the right, we have the same metric for phosphorus input as well, much higher amounts here needed for corn ethanol production relative to soy biodiesel. On the right, we have pesticide application, both in terms of total amount relative to how much energy we get out in the production process, as well as the different types, atrazine and so forth here, relative to soy biodiesel here, where the input is primarily glyphosate with Roundup-resistant soybeans. Next, let's look at atmospheric pollutants here. When we look at tailpipe emissions of corn ethanol and soy biodiesel for five different criteria pollutants here, of volatile organic compounds, carbon monoxide, particulate matter, SOx and NOx, we see the primary benefit here of adding this oxygenate and lowering carbon monoxide levels at the tailpipe. Soy biodiesel, we see much lower levels for four of these criteria pollutants relative to diesel. So all these higher or lower are relative to the fossil fuel displaced. Here in this case, relative to gasoline, here relative to diesel. If we look at the full life cycle of these biofuels, we actually see that the total amount of these criteria pollutants that are released for corn ethanol are higher relative to gasoline because of all the fossil fuels we need to burn in order to produce the corn ethanol.
Dr. Hill?
Yes, Senator Kubley?
Yeah, that was me. I guess if I remember my inorganic chemistry correctly, are the SOx and NOx, are those predominantly sulfites and nitrites, or are they the...
Yeah, sulfur compounds and nitrogen compounds.
Yeah, they're the compounds, but I mean, as I recall, there was a difference in toxicity between sulfites and sulfates. Can you say anything about that, or is that not true? Or would that cover both? I assume it covers both compounds, but aren't they predominantly one or the other?
It does cover both of those. I am not an expert in those in that area. This is simply a summary slide of those differences.
All right.
I'm sorry, I can't speak more.
That's okay.
That.
Thank you.
Full life cycle of soybean biodiesel here, we see that the levels of these VOCs are higher for the full life cycle relative to diesel, but still lower for these other three criteria pollutants. In terms of greenhouse gas emissions, what we find is a savings in the full life cycle production of corn ethanol of greenhouse gases relative to gasoline of about 12%, a savings in soy biodiesel production relative to diesel of about 41% of total greenhouse gas emissions. The economics here, Douglas Tiffany will speak more on this to you. What I wanted to show in this slide is the difference if we consider ethanol on a volumetric basis, as it's typically sold, versus an energetic basis. If we're interested in what these biofuels can do for us as energy sources, we need to consider them both. So what I have here at the top is the price of ethanol, prices and costs December for last month here, for ethanol considered on a volumetric basis and also on an energy basis. The reason these two are different is because ethanol has about two-thirds the energy content of gasoline. And so we define this quantity, the energy equivalent gallon, which is an amount of ethanol that is equal in energy to a gallon of gasoline. So on a volumetric basis, ethanol production costs of about $1.57 a gallon, a wholesale ethanol price of about $2 a gallon, and wholesale gasoline prices of $1.70 with the federal VEET credit on ethanol of 51 cents a gallon, the effective wholesale price, just considering this, of $1.49, so competitive with gasoline, certainly. On an energy basis, if we look at the total production costs and wholesale costs for ethanol, we see the difference there. With gasoline selling for $1.70 a gallon, a 77 cent per gallon energy credit for ethanol on an energy equivalent basis to gasoline, and an effective wholesale price of $2.25 on energy equivalent basis. So relative to the wholesale price of gasoline is actually higher if we consider that difference.
Well, yeah, Senator Anderson.
Yes.
Well, Mr. Chair, Dr. Hill, I don't believe you're taking into account different federal subsidies for gasoline.
That is correct.
That don't apply to ethanol. Yeah. So this just refers to.
Yes. Yes.
Well, and Dr. Hill. Well, Senator Anderson, were you done?
Yes.
You know, it seems to me that there's a piece of gasoline production. I mean, you've done a good job, I think, of factoring all the costs into ethanol. I'm not sure that same cost inclusion is true of gasoline, you know, and I'm not sure what it costs to send the Sixth Fleet to the Persian Gulf for a year or two, but if our main reason for sending it there is to protect our oil interests, doesn't that get included somehow in the cost of a gallon of gasoline? I don't know. Senator Hand?
Thank you, Chairman. I just wanted to ask a question to Mr. Hill or Professor Hill. Or
Professor? Doctor.
You mentioned that there were subsidies for gasoline. I'm not aware of any subsidies for gasoline. Can you tell me what they are?
I'm sorry. Senator Hahn, I was simply speaking here to the subsidy for ethanol production. I did not speak to a gasoline subsidy.
Senator Hahn.
And I know that's what you testified, but in response to Senator Anderson's question, you acknowledged that there were subsidies for gasoline. And I'm somewhat familiar with the oil industry. As far as I know, there are no subsidies for gasoline. And I just want to validate whether I'm mistaken.
Senator Hahn.
Back to health.
Chairman, I do not recall saying that there were gasoline subsidies. If I did, I misspoke. I subsidies in this case. Are you referring to this?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Dr., I think what you're trying to give us here is some breakdown of the fuel costs of two different fuels as well as the cost on an energy basis, and I think that's helpful. And, of course, one of the things that factors into the ethanol price is the direct subsidy that's coming to lower the consumer price. And my point is that those things do not exist in the gasoline price. And I know Senator Anderson mentioned that there were, but I'm not aware of any, and that's why I was asking if there are some that I'm not aware of. I'd like to know what they are because I'm not aware that there are.
Well, I think, Senator Hahn, you know, it seems to me that there are considerable costs to the use of a carbon-based fuel that are not factored into its cost. You know, and certainly one of those would be the amount of carbon that is emitted into the atmosphere. If you have something like Dr. Hill's research here together with Dr. Tillman that has a carbon-negative fuel produced, it seems to me that we don't have to figure in the cost of, you know, putting more and more carbon into the atmosphere. I guess that would be at least one response that I would have to that. I think there are, in fact, different ways that government does subsidize the oil industry, but, you know, they're not as direct payments, you know, as they are in the ethanol industry. Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair, that's all I was going to point out, and I don't know if Dr. Hill can give us any answer on that, but there's millions of dollars that are spent in taxpayers' money that subsidize the industry that keep gasoline prices where they're at.
Yep.
And I don't think that's really subject to debate, but I could certainly bring you the research to show that if you are skeptical, Senator Hahn, or maybe one of the economists here could help answer that for us.
And Mr. Chairman, just
Senator Hahn.
As far as I know, the oil industry since World War II has had one, I guess, what could be considered a subsidy from taxpayers that had to do with credits for capital costs. That structure was put in place to incentivize exploration and production in the period after World War II. And that has been the only. Now, my point with the subsidy is that I don't think, and I would be happy to see if there's any evidence to say otherwise, but I'm not aware of any direct taxpayer subsidy going to the oil industry to buy down the production costs or the consumer prices of gasoline or oil products. I don't believe they exist. And so to that degree, and I think you're right, there's all kinds of other things you can factor in and say, well, you know, oil or fossil fuels can have all other kinds of ancillary costs, and so can agriculture production. And so how broadly you want to draw the net of what's included in the cost, we could argue that ethanol is costed purely either, since we don't include all the production costs that go into growing corn and all the other things that need. But the point is, when it comes to the price of the fuel itself, there is a distinct difference, which is that there is a direct subsidy in the ethanol price and in the production that doesn't exist with gasoline. And to the extent that we want to focus on that, I think this is a helpful distinction.
Well, Senator Anderson.
I'm sorry to drag this on. I have research in my file drawers that gives lists of the subsidies to the industry. And, you know, I don't know what they are off the top of my head, but they're not price at the pump subsidies, so we don't maybe think of them in the same way, but they certainly help to bring the cost down. So I'd be happy to bring that to our next meeting.
That might be helpful, Senator Anderson. Senator Fredrickson, were you done, Senator Hand? I'm sorry.
Mr. Okay. Chairman, Senator Hand, to your asking if there's ever been a direct subsidy to oil, I think Marathon Oil received a subsidy sometime around 1980. I don't recall if I still had the information in my file, but that's one specific that's stuck in my memory. But I think probably the subsidies to oil companies come as tax expenditures rather than direct expenditures, where they get accelerated depreciation or accelerated tax benefits for more exploration. I'm not saying that's good or bad. It's just a way that the federal government has subsidized oil.
Senator Dale.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Hill, in your list of expenses for producing corn and soybeans, I don't recall you having something on the list called farm payments from the federal government, USDA payments. Are you skipping that cost?
Dr. Hill.
Chair, Senator Bill, the production cost of which you speak could be that question could be answered much better by Doug Tiffany, who's also here. Could that question be deferred to him?
Senator Hill?
That's fine.
Okay. We'll wait then, Dr. Hill.
If I may comment on the previous exchange, you've raised some excellent questions, both in terms of on the petroleum side and on the farming side. And the title of the project that I'm specifically working under with Dr. Tillman and Professor Tillman and Professor Pulaski is the full cost accounting of these biofuels compared to conventional sources. So these are just the first steps here in understanding what the full costs are. We have to quantify these environmental externalities, as they're called, in order to then put a dollar value on them. And so that is our charge, and this is just the first year of this project. We are actively pursuing that very question right now to get a better handle on that. By understanding that, we can do direct comparisons between the two different fuels, and those will include subsidy levels and externality valuations. Next, I want to speak about the expectations of these fuel, and some of you may have already been doing the math in your head from the previous slides that I put up here. If we used 100% of our corn harvest for ethanol production, we would produce enough ethanol to displace on a gross basis 12% of our total gasoline use in this country. There would certainly be some serious consequences of using 100% of our corn for this purpose, again, pointing out the disproportional effect on food markets relative to biofuel markets. For soy biodiesel, 100% of our soybean harvest, the oil from that specifically, would produce enough diesel to offset 6.4% of our diesel use, produce enough biodiesel. Here, I just want to highlight some of these major uses of the products. 50% of our corn crop is used directly to feed livestock. The remainder of the crop is exported, processed for human consumption, or converted to ethanol, of course. Soybean oil constitutes 80% of our edible oil consumption. Certainly you're familiar with the rising corn prices and the effects that has on food markets and also on ethanol production. Doug Tiffany will speak to more. Just some quotes here from people on the feed, food and fuel aspects of this use. I'll just highlight this by Keith Collins here. Last Sunday, or two Sundays ago, said, for ethanol production, we have a bull on the loose here, and it's going to have a lot of implications for American agriculture and our population. So three key criteria for the biofuels that we identified using these four E's, as I spoke of earlier, is we want biofuels that are producible with a feedstock that can be generated with low inputs, low amounts of fuels, low amounts of fertilizer, low amounts of pesticides. This impacts costs, it impacts the net energy balance, and it also impacts the environmental effects of these fuels. Ideally, we want to produce our biofuel feedstocks on land of low agricultural value, lands that have been degraded, lands that are not suitable to our highest crop production. We're going to have a doubling of food demand here in the next 50 years in the world, and our energy demands are also expected to double during that period of time. So our land, however, will not change the total amount we have, so we need to think very carefully how we're using our land. And then our conversion of our feedstock into biofuels should require low energy inputs, in particular low fossil energy inputs. We want to reduce those as much as possible. So now I'm going to shift more and give a little introduction here to cellulosic biofuels that will lead us into the research I did with David Tillman. Cellulosic biofuels are produced from this lignocellulosic portion of plant matter, the general plant matter from the cell walls that has a cellulosic component, which I'll talk about in a minute, and a lignin component. Cellulosic feedstocks that are primarily being considered are either monocultures of prairie grasses. Here, switchgrass has been the one that the Department of Energy has decided to focus its efforts upon. Wheat straw, this is a residue here. Corn stalks or corn stover is also a field residue. We can use some of these from fields, take some of the residue off without damaging the soils too much. And then also woody feedstocks like hybrid poplar here as well. State of the Union Address 2006, President Bush said, we'll also fund research into cutting-edge methods of producing ethanol, not just from corn, but these other sources as well. Projecting ahead off the AP Newswire, last night I saw Bush is expected to call for a sharp escalation of corn-based ethanol as a gasoline blend. So, again, this has not been said yet, but it's something to look out for tonight, what the energy component of this is going to be and what the energy feedstocks are expected. Cellulosic ethanol production here. I want to give you a quick overview of how it's similar and how it's a little different from corn ethanol production. Start here on the bottom. This is starch, and starch is just linking together of these individual sugar molecules down here. Those can be broken down into their components and then fermented to produce ethanol. This is cellulose. It is also just linking together different sugar molecules. They're linked together slightly differently, but again, it's the same basic sugars that form either the part of the corn that's used for ethanol production or the part of the lignocellulosic biomass that's going to be used for ethanol production as well. Corn production, the corn kernels are broken down, put into solution. Enzymes are added to break the starches down into sugar. Cellulosic production, essentially you add enzymes which break down the cellulose into the sugars which can be fermented. And this lignin portion, this is sort of the woody portion that's left over, can be used to provide steam and heat for the production process, and also can provide electricity, which can either be used directly in the plant or sold back to the grid. Our research focused primarily on the use of prairie biomass, diverse mixtures of native species. So here we have a prairie, big blue stem in here, some bergamot as well, quite lovely, and quite a diverse species composition here. And it's these interactions among the species that are going to be so important. I'll talk about those soon. Prairies need the above-ground biomass removed from them. They thrive on burning. They need the burning in order to be maintained as prairies. Otherwise, woody species start to move in. Fire is a natural process on our prairies, And what we're suggesting is, rather than simply letting in prairie burns all this biomass and carbon and energy just go up into the atmosphere, utilizing that, harvesting that, and sending it through these reactors and so forth to produce biofuels. So it's co-opting a natural process of biomass removal on the prairie for biofuel production. And a question that comes up a lot is, how does burning differ from removal in terms of the effect on the prairie and so forth? Well, the prairie grasses respond pretty much the same if you just remove the above-ground biomass versus burning it off. And so the experiment that I'm going to speak about was conducted at Cedar Creek up in Bethel, and it's this large biodiversity experiment planted on these very sandy, degraded soils of the Anoka Sand Plain. You can actually see just how sandy these are when you look at the tracks of the road around here. In fact, on this experiment, I believe the top few inches of the soil were even scraped off at the beginning to remove the seed bank. So we're talking about as degraded a soil as you can get here in Minnesota. And each of these little squares that you see is a 9-by-9-meter plot that was planted into differing levels of species number. So from a large pool of native prairie species, certain numbers were drawn randomly to be planted in this experiment. Some of these plots have no species in them. You can see those here. Some have a single species. Some have two. Some have four. Some have 16. Those are the ones we're concerned with for this experiment. So a good controlled experiment that allows us to look at the effects of biodiversity on different services that this land can provide for us. So one of the results that came from this is that as the number of plant species increases in these mixtures, the total amount of biomass energy that's produced also increases. So monocultures here, switchgrass monocultures were included in here as well. Very low diverse plots here. Each one of these is a single plot. Increasing diversity leads to higher biomass energy production. I think this is around 240% higher on average here in 16 species plots versus zero species plots. I should also mention that these plots are not fertilized, nor do they have any pesticide input.
If you had a line on that graph for corn ethanol, where would that be, Dr. Hill?
In terms of the total raw energy that would come out of it, in a slide or two, I will have a comparison that
All right.
will show that difference.
Thank you.
Another aspect of this is the sort of temporal aspect here, showing that we've been doing this for a long time, is that more diverse plantings of prairie, this is the highest diversity line here, become increasingly productive, more productive over time relative to the species mixtures of lower total numbers. Let me just say that again here because it's a bit confusing. More diverse plots become more increasingly productive.
Do you know where native prairie would fit in your, you know, how many species were represented on native prairie that has never been broken by a plow?
It could easily be 100 species.
Okay.
But you'll notice that there's sort of an asymptote, that it's a limit that it's approaching here. And you get very major effects here with the initial addition of species relative to adding here 8 more species. Why do we see these sorts of trends here? Some of it is because some of these species grow early in the season, some grow late in the season, so they're making more full use of the total light energy available to them. Some have shallow roots, some have very deep roots, so they're maximizing their use of the nutrients and water in the soils. Some are nitrogen-fixing species that actually provide the nitrogen for these plots that the other species can use, and other species like the grasses are very efficient at using those and respond quite well to the input. So we actually have all this complementarity that's adding to the total amount of production of biomass. So here's the slide you requested, looking at the energy difference from corn ethanol production and soy biodiesel production relative to three different biofuels that we would get from this particular degraded prairie, prairies that have very low levels of biomass. They're not our most productive prairies by any means. Please keep that in mind. On the left of each of these pairs, we have the total energy output for either corn ethanol production, soy biodiesel production. Converting this prairie biomass to electricity, this would be simply co-firing it in existing coal-burning electricity plants. And here we have the production of ethanol from this biomass. Here we have synfuel production via gasification followed by Fischer-Tropsch synthesis, essentially producing carbon monoxide and hydrogen from the biomass, which is recombined into synthetic diesel and gasoline. So on the left, we have our total energy output on each of these in different forms. Blue here is electricity. You get some electricity produced along with the ethanol. This is that amount I said that was sold back to the grid. And then we have liquid biofuels here as well. This would be ethanol in this case, and gasoline and synthetic gasoline, synthetic diesel in this case. It's important to think of electricity as a transportation biofuel as well. What we have here for corn on an energy per area basis, so gigajoules per hectare, we're going to go metric for a while, very large energy output on a per acre basis, but also very large energy input on a per acre basis. A lot of this due to the conversion energy that's required. Soy biodiesel on a per acre basis, we get out a lot less total biofuel, but we also use a lot less energy to produce that. So net energy output here of about 1914 here. For biomass, the production energy here, the amount of fuels required to produce these biofuels is so low because we're using part of this biomass to run the production process that gives us the biofuel. So essentially, we're taking part of the biomass and replacing this part of the bar right here. So we have net energy outputs from these very degraded prairies that are as high or much higher than corn ethanol production and soy biodiesel production on fertile lands. Talk about some of the environmental effects now. Two-thirds of the prairies actually below ground. You don't see it. It's in the roots of these plants, these deep roots that store the nutrients necessary for the prairie to regrow year after year to get that initial boost in spring. It also supports a very diverse community of other organisms and microbial organisms that are down here as well. What we're seeing here is the total amount of root carbon storage this is megagrams per hectare per year, and the total amount of soil carbon storage, megagrams per hectare per year, in these plots relative to the number of species in them. And we see that as we increase diversity, we increase both the amount of carbon that's stored in the soils and the roots directly, as well as the amount of carbon that is stored as the result of microbial activity.
All of our committee members may not be aware of a hectare, Dr. Hill. Isn't that about 2.5 acres?
Yes, 2.47 acres, correct.
Okay.
So let's go through some summary slides here comparing our current and future biofuels. What we have here is the net energy balance, or the net energy returned in production of corn ethanol, soy biodiesel, biomass to electricity, and biomass to ethanol, biomass to synfuel. So we see the equivalence on these low-input, high-diversity prairies on this degraded soil relative to the food-based biofuels produced with high inputs on our fertile soils. Down here we have the total greenhouse gas reductions relative to the fossil fuels that are displaced in producing these biofuels. And you see the low amounts from corn ethanol production and soy biodiesel production relative to the amount of carbon storage, carbon savings in producing biomass electricity and the other forms of biomass and fuels. Why do we have this difference? Well, we have the massive amounts of carbon storage in the soils themselves that contributes to this, as well as utilizing the energy in the biomass itself to run the production process, whereas here we have to spend some fossil fuels in order to run production. Some more environmental metrics here. Total fertilizer, nitrogen, and phosphorus for corn production. This is the same that we saw before. Just stack them on top of each other. This is for soy biodiesel, nitrogen and phosphorus inputs. And these are the nitrogen, the fertilizer inputs, actually phosphorus here, for the prairie biomass production for biofuels. Nitrogen is supplied by the nitrogen-fixing, primarily legume species, in the prairie. And these prairies actually can pull more nitrogen than the other species can use, and so the soils are actually becoming enriched with nitrogen as well as carbon, as we saw before. So we have a process here that's giving us biofuels as well as enriching the soils. Pesticide input for corn ethanol production, soy biodiesel, a little bit here for biomass, and that's because of initial spraying on the land to kill off that which is above before planting of the prairie. So some benefits of this low-input, high-diversity prairie. It's producible on degraded agricultural lands, sparing both our native ecosystems and our prime farmland for food production. It's highly sustainable and stable fuel supply. These native prairie species are able to withstand droughts very well because of their deep roots and give a very consistent biomass output. Cleaner rivers and groundwaters, both because you're not using the nutrients, the fertilizer and pesticide requirements in production of them, but also because if you place these strategically along watersheds, you can actually mitigate some of the damage that's done in regular agricultural intensive agricultural production. More net energy gain per acre than our food-based biofuels as currently produced. I should mention that here with the high fossil inputs, if you do some of the things like Doug Tiffany is going to speak about with using the co-products, you can change that balance as well. And it can also be used to power existing biofuel processing facilities. And that's what I'm going to talk about next here very briefly.
Well, Dr. Hill, how long does it take to establish a field with 16 species growing on it, and does the density of plant life increase with the age of the field?
That is correct. We can see from this slide here as they age here, at least through the 10 years that we see, you do get increasing amounts of biomass produced from them. So from a policy perspective, it would definitely be beneficial to encourage long-term plantings and maintenance of these prairies.
So you haven't reached a point where that levels off then, so you don't know beyond the 10-year period, you don't know if that would level off or continue to climb?
That is correct. So this is a long-term ecological study that will continue to monitor this. We have increased production here, both because the roots of the plants themselves are getting deeper, the plants are getting larger. We have increasing levels of nitrogen on the field, as I mentioned, and the carbon stores as well are helpful for maintaining moisture and such. So what I'm going to present next is a hybrid system that's going to use our existing corn supplies, the kernels, to actually produce the ethanol, but going to use the prairie biomass or an equivalent to prairie biomass in order to power the facility. So very similar to what we saw with lignocellulosic ethanol production. We'll just be essentially gasifying and this biomass from prairies and using it for process energy. Corn, as we've seen before, has our energy output in ethanol, the co-product DDGS. And this is the farm energy use and the conversion energy use, this large orange bar here. So this is our net energy gain of 25% that we saw. This is as currently produced. If we were to use prairie biomass for this conversion step, we essentially would knock out most of this orange bar here. There'd be a little left here, primarily in the transportation of the biomass itself. A little extra input of fossil energy in total, because we would be having to maintain the prairie. But as you can see, it's very small relative to the amount required for corn farming. And we'd actually have a net energy gain of this amount. This is the difference between these energy outputs and the energy inputs, of 189%. So this is a hybrid system that uses, if we figure it out, for every 1 acre of corn here, about 3/4 acre of prairie biomass. That's not all. If we use this 1 acre of corn, fertile land, and 3/4 acre of prairie on degraded land, this is the Cedar Creek land here, the very degraded soils, we actually can produce a carbon neutral fuel with a net greenhouse gas emissions of zero. And how does this come about? For corn ethanol production, about 2,700 pounds of CO2 are released per acre in farming and transport. About 2,600 pounds per acre are released in the processing using the biomass. So we're actually going to use the biomass from here for processing. On the prairie side, we have 200 pounds per acre used for the farming and transport, so much lower than in corn. The 2,600 here is the same ledger line as here. This is the total biomass growth in above ground that's used for conversion over here. And then these are the 2,900 pounds of soil carbon storage that's going on every year. So if you balance this out, it comes out to zero. So we've actually have a hybrid system here that has enough energy to produce the ethanol as well as be a net carbon neutral fuel. So it's very exciting to combine these different ideas into something that really could be quite beneficial. Ideally, our demands on food are going to be much larger, and we would eventually want to move, I believe, to higher levels of biomass to produce our biofuels if we pursue that route. But this is a wonderful system here that provides a nice immediate and intermediate step for biofuel production that's beneficial to the environment. And I would be remiss to neglect mentioning the demand side of this as well. I've talked about supply so far, but we really need to consider what benefit we could have by demand, by reducing demand. If we look at the average fuel economy by year here, 3-year moving averages for our cars, they've essentially leveled off here since 1985. Trucks, very much the same. If we look at the weight and performance of these vehicles, we see that the 0 to 60 time has decreased substantially. So we have much more powerful engines here at the same time that the weight has gone up substantially. So we are not doing the best job here of using our existing fuels wisely. So some conclusions here. Our current food and feed-based biofuels can meet but a small portion of our transportation energy needs and do so at great environmental cost. But the next generation lignocellulosic biofuels from waste and prairie grasses have distinct advantages over these current biofuels. Food-based biofuels produced with these lignocellulosic biomass feedstocks offer a promising hybrid system, as I showed with the 1 acre, 3/4 acre system. But in the short term, conservation really is likely to be of far greater importance to benefiting us on these four different aspects. With that, I'd like to conclude and thank the following individuals here and groups for their support.
Okay. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. I think it was on an earlier slide, but it may have been referring to something else as you got toward the end. You're talking about your hybrid system. But earlier you had some slides that talked about the amount of fuel that could be produced with these different processes. And so what is your conclusion? I think it was something like 6% of fuel could be 3% or 6% of diesel usage.
Mm-hmm. Yep, 6% diesel, 12% of gasoline on a gross basis.
And Mr. Chairman and Doctor, is that the that be a fair description of this hybrid model you described, that it's going to be something in the 6% of our fuel usage could be replaced by this? Is that, and that's if you use 100% of the acreage?
100% of the current acreage, yes. This was 2006 corn production. Again, think of this gross amount here, not including the energy that's required to produce it. So if we're using this hybrid system, what we would essentially be doing is giving us a better net benefit here rather than affecting this gross amount here, gross amount here. So we could increase the net amount that we get, as well as produce it from more environmentally friendly feedstocks, the renewable sources rather than the fossil sources.
Senator Hahn.
Just to follow up, the thing that we've heard that these biofuels will replace our fossil fuel needs, is that correct? It doesn't seem that's possible if we take 100% of our land and devote it to biofuels and we're able to kind of produce about 6% or 10% whatever it might be of our current. Is that just not realistic to assume that we can, through biofuels, replace 100% of our petroleum-based energy?
With these current two biofuels, it's correct. We can't grow ourselves out of this problem. And as to how it's sometimes advertised, I just ask you to read what the connotations might be from reading this and reading this. So we need to be realistic for what these current food-based biofuels can do for us. And we're currently looking at what the next generation of biofuels can do if we plant them on degraded land and so forth, what we can get from that.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you said something that I kind of missed about burning versus harvesting. Could you just repeat that? You said it works the same, essentially, to maintain the prairie?
Senator Chair, the important part, as has been shown by many studies, of stimulating the prairie to regrowth is to remove the above-ground biomass. Whether that's done by harvesting or by burning seems to be fairly equivalent on the studies I have seen.
Okay. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Doctor, just one last question. You were talking about the conversion process of cellulosic ethanol, and it's different than the traditional production. Now, I had understood that there were some technical or other issues that had not been resolved in finding a way to do that process efficiently. I understand it's theoretically possible to do it, and maybe it's even possible to do it in some experimental way, but as far as a ongoing production process, do you know where we are in terms of resolving those issues? How resolvable are they? What's your take on that?
So this would be an excellent time to launch into Doug Tiffany's work. He's an expert in this area. So if that,
all right,
your permission.
Well, Senator Dell, yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Hill, two quick questions. When you're calculating the cost of producing corn and soybeans and the fuel from it, what yield were you using? And then how about just burning whole kernel corn as a source of energy and avoiding all the cost of you need energy to produce ethanol. Well, how about and you're talking about burning switchgrass, how about burning whole kernel corn?
We have not considered burning whole kernel corn because of the added value of using it, the components of it, for these other products, for ethanol, for DDGS. Also, as far as I know, there are no vehicles that are powered with corn kernels for transportation biofuel use. So the idea here is to utilize it for something that can be incorporated into our existing transportation infrastructure.
Thank you.
And his second question, Senator Dale's second question was, do you consider the number of bushels per acre, or do you take statewide average? Or
the bushel per acre, that was done by, I believe, using spreadsheets that Doug Tiffany here has put together, and I believe he can answer that specifically. I must have been done using either Minnesota or U.S. averages, okay. One of the two.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hill and members. I think we'll go ahead with Dr. Tiffany. Maybe he can answer some of those other questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Douglas Tiffany. I'm a research fellow in the Department of Applied Economics at the University of Minnesota. I'm happy to compliment some of the information that Dr. Hill has given you and address some of those questions that seem to be coming along as well. I'm sure I'll create more on my own, too. The focus of my comments will be more on the status of the expansion in fuel ethanol, which is based on corn, and it will identify the opportunities that some of the firms are seeking to exploit by using biomass in the corn in the form of corn stover or even the distiller dry grains as a fuel to run those processing plants. So that's just a little background on me and some of the projects I've worked on. Interested in many of these topics, and I'm glad to talk about them at other times. But I better move along in interest of time. Among these trends, of course, they're in the news every day, and they'll be in the news even more after tonight, I'm sure, when I hear announcements of greater reliance upon corn-based ethanol. But I certainly want to talk about some innovative things that ethanol plants in Minnesota are trying right now. We'll talk about the cellulosic ethanol that Jason has touched on. Okay, this growth in our capacity is now about 6 billion gallons per year. In the U.S., we use 140 billion gallons of gasoline, so it's a small amount. We are headed for this 5% of our supply by 2012 was what was established in the Energy Policy Act of 2005. And the growth in fuel ethanol has been very rapid lately. It's been spurred by high profits and the interest in some large firms to enter this business. I shouldn't neglect biodiesel. It's part of this Energy Policy Act. It has tripled in production from 75 million gallons to 225 in the year 2006. Currently, some concerns being voiced about impacts on livestock production in this state and others with higher-priced corn. Here's a little more information about the perfect storm that happened. We had high crude oil prices. We had a rapid phase-out of MTBE across the country. We had very cheap corn, partly as a consequence of Hurricane Katrina, which kept a lot of corn from being shipped out of the Midwest. So the Energy Policy Act verified for the investing community a commitment to ethanol. Ways it can be made in many different ways, and we'll explore that a little bit more. But here's the ramp up in terms of plant capacity. And these numbers are, in terms of the building that is going on, are very dramatic. And there have been increased prices of steel and concrete to build these plants. This is what it looks like graphically. This is what the situation is through 2006. This is what it'll be over the next 2 years. It'll be that kind of a jump nationwide if you just use the midpoint of capacity to say that would be the production. So we're looking at some big changes across the countryside in terms of corn usage. And as opposed to the time in the early 70s when we had the Russian wheat deal and massive movement of grain out of the Midwest, These are businesses that are just down the road that'll be demanding corn.
Can I interrupt?
Their question.
Sure. Senator Anderson.
Just real quickly, Dr. Hill mentioned we're now using 70% of corn for ethanol, I think. 17. I mean, sorry, I thought that's what I said. At the top of that curve, what percent do you think we'll be
at? We'll be over 30%. So we'll be there fast. And, of course, there's a little bit of shakiness on will all these plants really be built? Well, there are agreements in place to build those. We'll see if people back out of them and really, in fact, build them. But it's quite a firm number. So, anyway.
Well, I think I've read, Dr. Tiffany, that there are currently 76 plants under construction nationwide, ethanol plants.
I believe that's right, and there are expansions on some others as well. Mm-hmm. So, very good. Okay, well, continue. This graph shows a relationship of ethanol prices above unleaded regular at a wholesale level. And usually there's a premium involved for ethanol, and that is to conform to situations where it's required to meet EPA standards as an oxygenate. There's been this oxygenate market, and so it has commanded a premium, even though in terms of its energy density, it's about two-thirds of gasoline. This particular table indicates what sorts of prices we have for gasoline based upon different prices of crude oil. So these would be the wholesale prices of gasoline related to $40 crude oil, $60 crude oil. This would be wholesale gasoline per gallon. If we were to add this 25 cents per gallon premium on it, we'd be at this level. Then usually there's a net back price, what is really received at that ethanol plant that takes into account the transportation. So I like to come close and understand what are the prices that are going to be received at those plants for these different ethanol prices. So we can get an idea of where this can compete. And it's favorable for ethanol plant economics to have high crude oil prices. One of the concerns of those plants and their bankers would be if crude oil prices were to drop drastically. Here's a situation from corn price and the cost of producing ethanol. Here's a range of corn prices, and these are prices from different size plants of the ethanol produced. And so we could have $4 corn. It could be produced by those plants for $1.88 per gallon. This would be a somewhat competitive price with crude oil when we're here around here's $60 crude oil. Anyway, we've got to keep our eye on crude oil in this business. Also have to keep our eye on natural gas prices, and that has spurred a lot of interest by these ethanol plants in some very innovative technologies. One thing to always remember, though, is there is this blender's credit or the volumetric excise tax credit that is received by companies that sell gasoline and include ethanol in the mix. This is the most powerful incentive that is out there for ethanol in this country. And it may be adjusted or changed, and that would have a dramatic influence on this industry. This 2005 energy bill allowed for more flexible marketing of gasoline and also the trading of credits. And this way, they encourage cellulosic ethanol because they are going to grant 2.5 credits per gallon of ethanol produced from a cellulosic source versus corn grain. So this will be a tradable credit that, for example, people in a particular state marketing gasoline could be relieved of this obligation of using ethanol. They would have to purchase this certificate. This will turn out to be cash in the pockets of people who can produce with cellulosic fuels. There are also some loan guarantees that have been established. They haven't been funded yet by the federal government, but that's been attractive as well. Here are the standards that were set. These are targets. You'll hear more discussion at the federal level about what these targets should be. But in 2007, we will have reached the level established for 2012. So the expansion has been much more rapid than anticipated. Here's some analysis by the USDA. They know these numbers are wrong, but this is what they did in 2005. They expected corn prices to increase. They expected soybean meal to decrease. They expected more corn acres and less soybean acres. I think these will happen. The magnitudes they know will be greater, and they will put out new baseline numbers in February. Now, they'll be very interesting. There will be some challenges more for swine production because of higher corn prices, less for cattle, and the situation, there's rapid growth in broilers and turkeys. That may be attenuated a bit, but it may continue. One point that USDA made, and this is from their baseline projections, is that the ethanol utilization of corn will outstrip exports. So we're changing the basic landscape of this market. Okay, let's talk about some innovations and how these firms are reacting to this. This is an ethanol plant in Minnesota. This is the one at Benson, Chippewa Valley. Some of them are choosing to gasify the syrup, which is an intermediate byproduct that is made, and they could gasify this and replace natural gas. There is a plant at Little Falls. So there's one at Winnebago that's using this process now. There's another plant at Little Falls that's using wood chips. This particular plant that I showed in the picture is looking at gasification of distiller dry grains or even corn stover to replace the natural gas they would use. They would clean up that synthesis gas and then use it in different places in that plant. Some firms are very interested in fractionation of that corn kernel. I'll tell you a little bit more about that. This is the sort of situation that prompted their strong interest in replacing their natural gas, and that's, of course, the high prices we had following Hurricane Katrina and the disruption to the infrastructure there. But the overall trend has been higher. It has come down this year as things have been repaired. Here's a little look at these opportunities. Of course, we have quite a bit of corn stover available in the countryside. Studies from the National Renewable Energy Lab indicate that half of this could be removed per acre, and most soils could be maintained with their levels of soil carbon. There's also opportunities to use this byproduct because it's right there, and there's sufficient energy to run that plant for the process energy and electricity that would be required to make the ethanol. So these are issues that are being studied, and I will skip by this. There's a study I'm doing with Dr. Vance Morey in biosystems and ag engineering to look at these ethanol plants and utilization of distiller dry grains for process heat, combined heat and power, and then sale of power to the grid. This may be an area where there may need to be some accommodation in state policy to allow these firms to sell power to the grid with a little bit more facility. These may turn out to be renewable power plants that can be quite reliable, like baseload power. And so they may complement well the wind we have already. So I guess I can show you quickly on this graph what happens to these firms when we have higher natural gas prices. This graph starts at $8 per decatherm or per million therms, and I have different schedules of ethanol prices. We see here our profits or losses for a typically sized plant. We have corn prices along this axis. So if we just were to say ethanol was $1.50, this plant would break even with $2.90 corn. But if we move on to more expensive natural gas, then this break even drops to $2.70. This is the sort of scissors that these plants would be caught between. Natural gas prices, their number two expenditure. Corn, their number one expenditure. So this is something that's driving their behavior. Some plants are choosing to be built that would use coal. We have one in this state. We have more in other parts of the country. I've touched on some of these things already, and I will say that there is certainly enough energy in the distiller dry grains produced for all these uses that are right at that plant: electricity, process heat, and power to sell to the grid. Okay, this is an excellent feed. It's 28% crude protein. It's pretty high in fat and fiber because the starch of the kernel has been used up in the fermentation process. But it has a little bit more variation than soybean meal, and it doesn't have the same balance of amino acids that are so important for poultry and swine production. We're going to have a mountain of this feed around this country. And if we were to look at the amount of grain-consuming units around the country and we went with maximum inclusion rates by animal scientists, we would be hard-pressed to use this 28.3 million metric tons that we'll be having very soon. So there's going to be a real challenge, and I think that this byproduct is going to be very cheap and it will be attractive for people to consider in this fashion as a biomass fuel.
So we can still have steak and fuel.
Hey, these are exciting times for people in the livestock business as they are people growing corn. There may be this cattle feeding may move closer to ethanol plants to use this byproduct in a wet form. That would reduce energy requirements. There's research at Iowa State University to look at a diet for cattle that would strictly be of corn stover or corn stalks and this distiller dry grains product. It would be a somewhat slower average daily gain, but it is possible for the ruminant animals to live this way and to be raised this way. So it could change the dynamics of our feed industry and livestock industry in this country. Let's talk about fractionation a little bit. Here's your basic corn kernel, and these are the portions, constituents of it. They are nested more, most of the starch is here in the endosperm. Most of the protein and oil are in the germ. More of the fiber is in the pericarp. There is also equipment. This is a centrifuge that could separate oil from the liquid stillage at an ethanol plant. This could be used to make biodiesel at many of these ethanol plants. This particular company reports extraction of 75% of that oil. So another technology comes along to be very profitable for these firms to employ. There are a number of firms doing this, exploring this, but there are very few ethanol plants that are doing it. One is in Monroe, Wisconsin, is doing a fractionation. Some others are looking at it very carefully. I think they may do it as their profits decline. And they may find it useful to have a more valuable portfolio of products to sell. Here's something that Jason talked about. I will give you a little bit more information in a different way on utilization of lignocellulosic. Of course, as Jason said, they're both carbohydrates or sugars. This lignin is used to run the process and produce electricity. And it will be necessary for there to be acid pretreatments, whether we're talking about corn stover or native prairie grasses, under most technologies that are being considered. After this acid pretreatment, there would be enzymes. There have been some big developments in improving enzymes. Then there would be bacteria and yeast that either one could be used for fermentation. In fact, there's research at the University of Minnesota to put yeast and bacteria together as a tag team. One could eat the six carbon sugars, the other would eat the hemicellulose, which are five carbon sugars. So there's some opportunities to improve this in that regard. Some of the best studies have been done by the U.S. Department of Energy, and they've looked at corn stover or wood chips. And the great thing about these studies is they've identified the equipment they would use and their costs. And it's important, I'd say, at a state level to understand that a cellulosic ethanol plant would produce 3.7 kilowatts per gallon of ethanol produced. And it would just use about a third of it, and so there would be quite a bit of power to be sold. These plants have to have access to the grid in order for their economics to work out. This would represent about 10% of their revenue to be selling power. Okay, there's some big improvements that have occurred in enzymes, and there's a company, Iogen, a Canadian company, which... there have been about five companies, and Iogen is among those, that have identified places where they'd like to build a plant, but they're waiting for the funding to be released from the federal government before they do so. Those plants will probably be built, take a couple of years. They'll need to be run a couple of years, and then I think we'll really know something about how to do cellulosic ethanol. I guess I'm probably running ahead into some of these topics, but the idea is to exploit some of these plentiful feedstocks. There's a question raised earlier about how much this could be. The cellulosic feedstocks in this country could be much greater in terms of the opportunity to grow ethanol, produce ethanol, than the corn grain. It would be possible to produce about 30% of the U.S. gasoline supply from a combination of grain and fiber sources. There was a big study that came out last year called the billion-ton study, and it says there's about 1.3 billion tons of dry biomass available. Some of it isn't so nice to work with. Some of it's used for other things, but it's there, and it'll be a major push of the Department of Energy to try to work into that. So one thing, I guess I touched on this earlier, bankers and investors in ethanol plants have to worry about low crude oil prices. Lower ethanol prices, they're getting the higher corn prices, but I'd comment that many of the ethanol plants can pay up to $4 and still operate, $4 per bushel. They are also fearful of higher natural gas prices. Well, this graph is a little bit off the topic. It does show a time in U.S. history in 1980 when we did have a big drop in usage. U.S. dropped utilization of petroleum by 19% in a very short period of time. This was driven by some government policies of reducing speed limits and enhancing the efficiency of automobiles and other vehicles. So that's something that we haven't seen on the scene lately. Many efforts directed toward conservation. But Jason identified it. That's the low-hanging fruit, is opportunities to reduce our usage of energy, especially in transportation. Among the grow responses that will happen across the countryside, I can see we will probably have a shift to more corn on corn, or we may have rotations that are... See, our typical rotation is a year of corn and a year of soybeans. There's some advantages for this because there's residual nitrogen produced by that soybean crop that the corn crop can use. In this case, more people will go to a situation of corn, and then a year of soybeans. And this particular table was produced by people at Iowa State, Mike Duffy and David Correll. They assumed nitrogen prices of $0.30 per pound. That's about what we have today. So I'd expect to see this reaction in our countryside, more corn acres, less soybeans.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Tiffany, I retired from farming about 10 years ago, and the comparison of the yield of corn my son gets farming now compared to what I did is just astronomical. There's a huge difference because of the genetics and technology. Have you tried to factor in how much corn yield will increase over the next few years because of better genetics and better growing systems? Because certainly that will not stay stable if it's anything like it has been the last few years. It's typical now of farmers to get... It's not unusual for farmers to be getting over 200 bushel an acre corn.
Senator Frederickson, the analyses I've been seeing have been contemplating a yield trend increase that we have had, and some people have looked at it over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. So that would, and they've gone to a shorter period of time because the rate of improvement, much as you've identified, has hastened. And so despite that, there will be challenges, I think, in terms of price for livestock producers. And they will go to producing probably more corn on corn than in the past.
Okay. Senator Frederick.
Chairman, Dr. Tiffany, just a comment. By livestock producers, I'm assuming you mean farmers that are producing livestock. I'm also concerned about the farmers that raise corn just for grain and need to make a profit just on their on the return per acre on their corn crop. So it may be bad for the folks that are raising just raising pork, but it might be good for the corn farmers.
Senator Frederickson, I appreciate your comment. Many farmers have several enterprises. I guess the reason we have certain livestock enterprises in this state has been partly because we've had cheaper corn here. And that may change a certain amount as we have more local demand. It'll be an incremental change. There'll be adjustments made in small bites here and there.
Okay. Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Tiffany, I want to get back to this burning corn issue. There's a lot of people out there with corn stoves that are just plain heating their house with corn without processing it at all. And to me, that seems like a simple way of doing it without going through the expensive process of trying to get a little ethanol out of each bushel. And so what do you know about the economics of burning corn to heat a house or burn corn to make electricity or burn corn to use that energy for some useful purpose?
Okay. Senator Dill, the best comparison would be what is the cost of LP gas or natural gas to get you the equivalent BTUs. And last year, when we had cheap corn, $2.20 in the countryside, a BTU basis, corn was cheaper, a cheaper fuel than natural gas. Since that time, natural gas has gotten cheaper, corn has gone up. There is definitely some attractiveness of using fuel you produce right there on your own farm or nearby. And there are some additional expenditures. You have some ashes to dispose of. You have some different equipment in terms of the stove itself, and some storage of corn. So there is an evaluation going on right now for the experiment station at Staples, where they have put in a corn burner. And so we'll be producing a trade-off table on the amount, the natural gas trade-off with corn price. And I'm sure corn prices, if they seem high, we'll see some moderation. We're having a lot of excitement in this market right now as more acres are bid into corn by the price signals out there. The technology works, but it's as Dr. Hill said, it's not a liquid fuel, a transportation fuel.
Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I asked Dr. Hill a question, which he said Dr. Tiffany was going to answer, which he hasn't answered yet.
Well,
and it has to do. Getting back to another question I had, we had a long list of the cost of producing corn and soybeans and so forth, and in that list of expenses, I did not see federal farm program benefits listed there, which is
a cost to the taxpayers?
The cost of farm payments was identified in that first paper that compared ethanol and biodiesel. So that was identified.
Yeah, I didn't see it.
That would that can be expected to be reduced with the higher corn prices that we will be having.
Yeah, well, Senator Dill.
Well, that's right. If corn prices stay high, it'll be down, but they'll always be, at least under the current farm program, part of your payments are not price dependent. And of course, we got a new farm program coming, so we don't know what that's going to be like.
Okay. Senator Hahn.
Dr. Turkey, thank you for your presentation. Question for you. If we did not have the mandates on consumption and the subsidy to the production side of this business, would this be an economically viable, sustainable business if the fossil-based fuels stay stable in price? In other words, trying to get at what the underlying economics of this are and whether they require ongoing mandated consumption and ongoing subsidization to make it work, or if it ever is going to become competitive unless petroleum fuels go much higher than what we've experienced traditionally. I mean, what's your take on that?
Senator Hahn, there are a couple aspects to your question. In this past year, especially in 2005, ethanol was cheaper on a BTU basis than gasoline. Now, there have been some, and that it would be without the, at that time, it was without that volumetric excise tax credit. So that was kind of an extreme case. It was cheaper to get your BTUs from corn ethanol at that time, in the spring of 2005. Now, with respect to the other fuels, they certainly have the opportunity to use depletion allowances, as Senator Frederickson identified, and this is a big advantage. It's kind of like setting your own depreciation rate on something that's in the ground and no one can exactly verify. So that's been an advantage that the petroleum industry has realized, especially for domestic reserves of petroleum. See, I think I'm forgetting a part of your question. Excuse me.
Senator Hahn.
I've been trying to, for a number of years, understand the economics of this industry and whether it can be sustainable without doing the two things we do right now, which is we require people to buy it, and we subsidize pretty heavily on the production side. And do we ever get to a point where we say, well, this can be competitive with other fuel choices without having those kinds of taxpayer inputs into the process?
Okay, Senator Hahn, the biofuels have been subsidized. And but I guess one thing pointed out by the study done with Dr. Hill is if we look at the full cost in terms of what are the costs of our emissions, greenhouse gases, that's a more complete way to look at what we're doing in society. And the one thing that most people would identify as being omitted in looking at petroleum is the impact of carbon emissions to the environment. And the opportunity with renewable fuels, the biofuels, is we're essentially growing them on an annual basis and producing that fuel. So we're not pumping from deep within the earth the carbon that ends up in our atmosphere and changes the situation. So some people say, well, that is neglected in the full accounting of biofuels versus petroleum. Of just where you're going to put your money if you're going to invest in oil, ethanol, the ethanol and biodiesel have required certain amounts of subsidy, substantial amounts, things to get started. Infant industry.
Okay. Oh, were you finished, Senator? Okay. Dr. Tiffany?
That's really... I guess here's a few summary points. There have been volatile returns in dry mill ethanol. This will still be the dominant technology for some time. It is possible to replace the natural gas in production and raise that net energy ratio, dry grind ethanol, using the byproducts or corn stover, or, as Jason identified, native prairie grasses in a hybrid system. It's going to take us a little time to learn how to run things with lignocellulosic, and I know that's an interest in state government to see how this could be fostered and improved upon. Identified that these plants will also be power producers, and so they must have some opportunities maybe to streamline that acquisition of a power purchase agreement. So with that, I'm happy to conclude my remarks. Be happy to entertain any other questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Tiffany. Is there any other questions from the committee? Anyone else in the audience who would like to say a word? Okay. Well, with that, committee member, Senator Frederick.
I don't have a question. I'd just like to make a comment about something we heard. We heard about Dr. Tillman's work at Cedar Creek, and I just wanted to share with the committee that that work is partly funded by a $400,000 appropriation from the Environmental Trust Fund from the last LCMR recommendation. Mm-hmm. And in the LCCMR recommendations you'll see coming before the full committee this year, there's a recommendation of another $659,000 to his research from the Environmental Trust Fund.
Yeah, well, thank you, Senator Frederickson. That's interesting information. We don't have another meeting of this subdivision scheduled, but if you just watch your email, I know there will be a couple of other ones at least coming before we look at specific bills. Thanks for coming. Meeting is adjourned.